John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, 29th of May, 2012. Egypt confirms Mohamed Morsi and Ahmed Shafiq in election runoff. Al-Aqsa Foundation slams provocative settler tour, and fuel crisis impacts water and sanitation services in Gaza. And more. Stay tuned. After years of rivalry, Hamas and Fatah start working towards Gaza elections with news that the Central Elections Commission has been granted permission on Monday to begin working in Gaza. The government that will oversee the elections will be agreed upon by President Abbas and Hamas leader Khalid Mashal and should be announced sometime next week. The current fuel crisis in Gaza, now in its fifth month, is causing extended power outages that severely disrupt the lives, health and livelihood of the region's 1.6 million residents. It also severely affects the fuel-dependent fishing industry, already crippled by restricted access to Gaza's fishing waters imposed by Israel's blockade. So the Gaza power plant produced electricity at less than 30% of capacity in April, causing severe disruption to basic services, including water, health and sanitation. The Coastal Municipal Water Utility says the situation is critical, with up to 40% of the 1.6 million population under blockade getting water in their houses only once every 4 days. And it will get worse as summer approaches. The second stage of Egypt's presidential race will be between Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party and the former Air Force General Ahmed Shafiq, a law and order candidate and Mubarak's last prime minister, who received 24% and 23% of the 50% of votes cast, respectively. Nearly half of the first-round votes went to candidates on the middle ground, and turnout was a respectable 46% of 50 million registered voters. Of all the likely outcomes of the first round of the two-stage contest, this is the most polarised, pitting the long-banned Brotherhood, the world's oldest Islamist movement, against a secular figure who is seen as a remnant of the old regime. A court in Istanbul has voted unanimously to approve an indictment against Israel's former military chief, Lieutenant General Gabi Ashkenazi, along with the former heads of its Navy, Air Force, Intelligence and Military Intelligence. They face 9 consecutive life terms in prison, if convicted. The indictments arose out of a violent attack in the early hours of May 31, 2010, by Israeli commandos on a flotilla of ships heading for Gaza with aid, medical supplies and unarmed peace activists. The ships were trying to breach Israel's blockade of Gaza. The Mavi Marmara was boarded by Israeli commandos, who killed 9 Turkish volunteers and injured hundreds of others. The Al-Aqsa Foundation for Wach and Heritage in occupied East Jerusalem stated that dozens of Israeli settlers, accompanied by many soldiers and police, conducted a provocative tour in the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, raising Israeli flags and preventing local worshippers from accessing the site. The Al-Aqsa Foundation stated that raising Israeli flags in the mosque compound is a provocative act and a violation of the sanctity of the holy site. And these tours are taking place while most Palestinians in the occupied territories are denied access to Muslim and Christian holy sites in occupied Jerusalem. Bassem Tamimi, a leading member of the grassroots movement against the Israeli annexation wall and settlement construction in the village of Nabi Saleh, was sentenced to 13 months imprisonment and a further 17 months suspended sentence today at an Israeli military court. He was released following the judgment, having already served the 13 months imprisonment, waiting for his case to come to trial. In the next stage of the Palestinian Contractors Union dispute with UNICEF, the Palestinian Contractors Union has urged all Palestinian contractors and suppliers to boycott any bids offered by the UN Children's Emergency Fund, UNICEF, until it decides to withdraw all bids offered to Israeli companies. And that's all today from IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, the 29th of May, daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Cassis and William Temple.
Rain reported Saturday. On the 20th of May, the 3,000th NATO soldier died as a result of the war in Afghanistan. He was an American sailor who died of complications of wounds suffered earlier. Afghanistan, last Thursday, another NATO soldier was killed by a roadside bomb. Afghanistan, Friday, 2 more NATO soldiers were killed in southern and eastern Afghanistan in separate attacks. Afghanistan, Saturday, a U.S. soldier was killed by an IED blast in Zareh, Kandahar province. NATO reported a total of 4 soldiers killed in various attacks. Afghanistan, yesterday, 2 NATO soldiers were killed in a helicopter crash in eastern Afghanistan. A second aircraft crashed with no fatalities, no word on whether or not they were shot down. Afghanistan reported yesterday. A spokesman for the governor of Paktia province reported that a NATO airstrike has killed a family of 8 in the Gurda Surya area. There has been fighting in the area, but the official says the family had no link to the insurgency. NATO claims they are investigating. Pakistan yesterday. 2 separate U.S. drone attacks killed at least 9 alleged insurgents in Miran Shah, North Waziristan. One drone bombed a house, the other drone bombed a car or other vehicle. Pakistan, Friday. Dr. Afridi, the doctor that told the CIA where to find bin Laden, was sentenced to 33 years in prison for spying. This says volumes about what Pakistan thinks of the U.S. The U.S. response was to reduce U.S. financial support for the Pakistani regime by $33 million, $1 million for each year their agent will spend in prison. Egypt, today. Protesters burned the campaign headquarters of Hosni Mubarak's last prime minister who is running for president in the upcoming election. The last thing people want in Egypt is more of what Mubarak was selling. Mr. Barack Obama, the events of Egypt, as well as the events of the war, show that people in the Middle East have had enough of the things that have been going on since the days of George W. Bush. Now is the time to pull the plug on America's part of this. Bring all the troops home today. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
On December 31, 2011, President Obama signed the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, which carries several ominous provisions. However, Section 1021 of the NDAA is the most alarming in that it empowers the current and all future presidents to indefinitely imprison U.S. citizens and non-citizens who were part of or substantially supported al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners. Persons accused under this provision can be held by the U.S. military indefinitely or transferred to any nation in the world without charge, trial, or access to an attorney. Two lawyers, Carl J. Mayer and Bruce Afrin, filed a lawsuit on January 13, 2012, on behalf of seven high-profile plaintiffs challenging the legality of what they assert are unconstitutional provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act. Plaintiffs in the case, known as Hedges v. Obama, include former New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and America's most well-known dissident and linguist, Noam Chomsky. On May 16th, Federal Judge for the Southern District of New York, Catherine Forrest, issued a preliminary injunction that bars the U.S. government from applying indefinite military detention under Section 1021, finding that the law violates rights of free speech and due process. Your reporter spoke with Carl J. Mayer, one of the two lawyers who filed the NDAA lawsuit, who talks about his recent court victory and the challenges ahead for the goal of overturning the law.
Section 1021, I think, poses the greatest challenge to civil liberties in America since the McCarthy era. What Section 1021 did is it would allow the military to put in indefinite detention anyone that, in the government's eyes, were engaged in the following, quote, substantially supporting al-Qaeda or, quote, associated forces of al-Qaeda. So this standard is so nebulous that it can encompass anyone. It can encompass journalists, writers, activists, and in fact, those were precisely the seven plaintiffs that were in this case. We call them the Freedom Seven, and they are Daniel Ellsberg, the legendary Pentagon whistleblower and author of the Pentagon Papers. There is Chris Hedges, the former Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times and currently journalist for Truthdig. There was Noam Chomsky. Another plaintiff is a woman named Birgitta Jonsdottir, who is a member of Iceland's parliament and was associated with the WikiLeaks effort. And then there were three young leaders, Kaiwar Gala, who is one of the founders of Occupy London, Alexa O'Brien, who is a founder of US Day of Rage, which is associated with Occupy Wall Street, and a young leader named Tangerine Boland, who is a founder of a group called Revolution Truth. So those are the plaintiffs that stood up, and I think I described in short order, the onerous provision of Section 1021.
Explain to our listeners a bit of what Federal Judge Catherine Forrest based her decision on to call for a preliminary injunction against Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Well, what was so onerous about this legislation is that it would allow any of the group I mentioned before, like our plaintiffs, anyone the government deemed to, quote, substantially support al-Qaeda or associated forces, it would allow the government to number one, place these people in indefinite military detention, quote, until, quote, the end of hostilities, which is potentially forever in the war on terrorism, or try these people in a military court, not a civilian court, where you get to go before jury of peers, or render these people to a foreign country. So those are the three things the government could do under this. And what Judge Forrest courageously did was enforce the Constitution and rule that the First Amendment protects all of these people in their activities and protects all journalists in their activities. For now, we have a victory. The government has 60 days to decide whether or not to appeal. Even if they do, it's going to be a long time on this appeal, and during that time span, the injunction will stay in place. Or, and this is what we've been calling on the government to do, it's really high time for the administration to own up to the fact that this statute is wholly unconstitutional. It needs to be expunged permanently. And President Obama, the former constitutional scholar, he understands perfectly well that this is unconstitutional, and he should recognize that by directing his Justice Department to enter into a stipulation that from now that they will accept a permanent injunction against the NDAA. And that's what they need to do. I hope that other federal judges will read this opinion and take stock of what Judge Forrest has done. And also, I think that citizens should understand that you can, and the young lawyers will understand that you can fight the federal government and win in court. It doesn't happen all the time, but it's something you must try to do, in addition to the protests and other activities that we need to take our country back.
As you said, we don't know at this point whether the federal government will appeal this case, and it could take many more months to find out where this ends up. But are you concerned that this case could land before the Supreme Court with its conservative majority and its history of favoring extraordinary measures by the government and military in the war against terrorism?
It would take a while to go up to the court. In the meantime, we have prevailed, but it is a concern. However, it's not an overwhelming concern because Judge Forrest was very good in her opinion in citing Supreme Court precedent that was authored by the conservative justices. For example, she cited Citizens United, which is a case probably familiar to your listeners, which is a very aggressive First Amendment opinion that protects the corporation's right of free speech to spend money on elections. Now, this is a case I do not agree with in the least, but this is actually the first useful citation of Citizens United, I think, ever, because essentially what Judge Forrest was saying is, if you're going to extend maximum free speech rights to corporations, you have to extend them to citizens, journalists, activists, etc. There were a number of citations that Judge Forrest made to opinions by the Supreme Court authored by the Conservative Five that I think will help this opinion stand the test of time.
That was Carl J. Mayer, one of two lawyers representing plaintiffs in a lawsuit challenging indefinite detention provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act. Find links to more information and analysis on the constitutionality of the law by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
On the 24th of May, activists participating in Mountain Justice Summer and activists from RAMPS, Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, blockaded both a road and a transport barge associated with a mountaintop removal coal mining project on Cayford Mountain. Nobody was arrested, even though activists were physically locked to the barge, which went nowhere, even after police were able to force the road blockade to let a truck through. Here's what things sounded like at the blockade. Trouble in the mountains for those who think they have the power to dominate local people and blow up their mountains for profit. For years now, there has been an obstructive civil disobedience campaign that has cost these mines weeks of downtime. Many or most of the activists fighting against the destruction of the very mountains they live on are local to West Virginia and Tennessee. One of the most active groups is RAMPS, Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival. The coal industry no longer has reliable loyalty of local people due to the ongoing destruction of homes and entire communities to make way for removing the very mountains that underpin Appalachian culture. Extractive industries that destroy our good earth are increasingly under siege as people fight back. On the 24th of May, the Vancouver branch of the Canadian Institute of Mining, Metallurgy, and Petroleum held a lunch event at a ritzy hotel pushing their proposed Raven coal mine. The mine is proposed to be dug on unceded Native American land, land belonging to the Petlatch Nation. This industry event was raided and forcibly shut down by community activists opposing the mine. As CEO of Compliance Energy Corporation, John Papix, mentioned that the mine had opposition, six people started throwing dead fish everywhere. More activists dumped piles of coal onto the floor. As the stench of long dead herring rose, the mine bosses and the bankers had to step through piles of coal and rotting fish without ruining their shiny pimp shoes. All fled the room and abandoned the conference. Some of the mainstream press reported that the stench was manure, but organizers reported they used fermented dead herring, like the kind the mine would kill. Not one of the protesters was captured, and nobody was injured. Flawless victory!
Since the world sank into deep recession in 2008, economic cooperatives have emerged to provide a proven alternative to market failures in places as diverse as coffee growers in Kenya to the Rust Belt in the United States. According to the news magazine In These Times, an estimated 1 billion people are members of cooperatives, producing earnings equal to the gross domestic product of Canada. During the Great Depression, cooperatives were launched in the housing and manufacturing sector. Later, co-ops gained popularity during the 1960s, when many community health food outlets were founded. When the Occupy Wall Street movement was born last fall, activists tapped into the United Nations International Year of Cooperatives, with organizers calling for the new protest movement to create an economy worth occupying, as many promoted the cooperative business model. One of the most famous examples of successful worker cooperatives in the world is found in the Mondragon region of Spain, which has survived Spain's economic turmoil. But the cluster of worker enterprises has now created two forms of membership, diluting the ability of workers to vote their co-op shares. In Argentina, where occupied factories were transformed into cooperatives in the early part of the decade, enthusiasm has waned as co-ops seek legal status. Economist Gar Alperovitz, author of America Beyond Capitalism, has urged the Occupy movement to move beyond street protests to create new independent institutions, including worker-owned cooperatives. In Chicago, Occupy activists have joined with the United Electrical Workers Union to buy the Republic Windows and Doors factory that was famously taken over by its workers after owners shut the plant down in 2008.